Podcast Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
Welcome to the first installment of Brew Crime's Powerful Women with Powerful Podcasts January miniseries. Today's episode welcomes Autumn's Oddities to the show. If it's creepy and weird, you're going to find it there. The podcast showcases the strange and unusual, and it's made by the strange and unusual. In this episode, you're going to learn about the girl in the chute, Phoebe Handschuk, on the evening of December 2nd, 2010. 24-year-old Phoebe Handschuk was found dead on the floor of the refuse compactor room at the bottom of her luxury apartment complex in South Melbourne, Australia. Phoebe was heavily intoxicated at the time of her death, but the coroner ruled she had put herself into the chute, despite her apartment being ransacked and the troubled relationship with her older, live-in boyfriend. This is another case where you can decide for yourself if this was an accident, suicide, or murder. Now pouring Autumn's Oddities for the enjoyment of your earholes.
You like spooky things. Of course you do. You're here, aren't you? Maybe you need some holiday gifts for the cool friends or family in your life. Baby Teeth, T-E-I-T-H, yes, spelled differently, makes some of the coolest clothes with collections ranging from 80s music, think The Cure, Sushi and the Banshees, Prince, The Talking Heads, Depeche Mode, Joy Division, and my favorite, Bowie. And I also have it on good authority that there will be a Bowie season collection dropping shortly, even 80s movies, and something to clothe your entire spooky family with newborn sizes ranging through adult. So if you want to keep on repping spooky season and just great music year round, go to Baby Teeth, BabyTeith.com and use code Autumn's Oddities, AUTUMNS. Oddities for 10% off year round. Stay spooky, my friends.
Darkcast Network. The light shines brightest on our indie podcasts.
Hey, welcome back to Autumn's Oddities. I am your host that is currently packing a whole ass house to move to a new house on Saturday. Autumn. Yeah, so I'm recording this episode a little early, and I'm hoping to have Monday's episode ready to go before we move, but if that is not possible, I'll be releasing an episode that was previously a Patreon-only episode. Don't worry, Patreons, I will make it up to you in the form of an intriguing little episode about Elvis Presley and his dead twin that talked to him from beyond the grave. Yes, you heard me right. That is a whole thing that I just found out about on an old episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So today's case is another that I heard and just thought, what the fuck? The death of Phoebe Handschuk, or as some came to know her in the Australian press, the girl in the chute, is another one of those cases that you see the facts and you just know that the cause of death definitely was not suicide. Let me give you a little bit of background information. You may not have heard of this one since it is Australian. On the evening of December 2nd, 2010, 24-year-old Phoebe Handschuk was found dead on the floor of the refuse compactor room at the bottom of the luxury apartment complex she lived at called the Balencia in South Melbourne, Australia. And if you've ever lived in a high-rise apartment building, I've lived in like a luxury complex. It wasn't a high rise. It did have a trash chute, but I think it only went down like two floors. One time someone set it on fire. Phoebe had fallen feet first from the 12th floor refuse room, down the waste disposal shaft, to the trash compactor below. The toxicology report later revealed that Phoebe had a blood alcohol reading of 0.16%, as well as prescription drugs in her system at the time of her death. The apartment she shared with her boyfriend had been ransacked, but there was very little investigation done before ruling her death a suicide. To this day, there have been no reported incidents of a cause of death such as this in the history of Australia. So to say that this type of death is rare would be an understatement. Before we get into the details of Phoebe's death, I want to talk a little bit about who she was. And all of this information was provided by Phoebe's family members on the website phoebehandsjuck.com. Phoebe was born by emergency cesarean section early on the morning of May 9th, 1986, which was the year of the Chinese tiger, and her mother actually called her Tiger Cub. Her mother described her as a beautiful, strong, and healthy baby. That's just what you want in a baby. And she was the firstborn child in her family and was described as an old soul. Phoebe was a wild child with a big imagination, and she was very physically active. She loved natural spaces and wild places, specifically the ocean. In school, she was very popular. She loved to socialize. Phoebe was also an athlete. She played basketball and ran track. But she started experimenting with drugs at quite a young age, around the time her parents divorced. She struggled with alcohol and used it to overcome her anxieties. She also suffered from depression and was taking medication and seeking counseling to assist her. I'm sorry if you heard a click. I have a lozenge in my mouth. At 14, Phoebe was quite hormonal, romantic, intuitive, and very sensitive. And that's a quote from her grandmother, Jeanette Campbell. And she gave that quote to the inquest into Phoebe's death. At age 15, she started hanging out with the wrong crowd. So she was experimenting with drugs, including alcohol, speed, ecstasy, and marijuana. She ran away from home and lived in a squat in the city's north for 8 weeks with an ex-convict, his partner, and their baby. After returning home, she began taking antidepressants to curb her mood swings. By age 16, as Robin Bowles reveals in her book Into the Darkness, The Mysterious Death of Phoebe Handsjuck, which is where I got most of my information, Phoebe was in a relationship with a teacher who was almost twice her age, and this began a pattern for falling in love with older men. Natalie, her mother, says it was her intolerance for alcohol in particular that was responsible for driving her off course. And she said, there are people who can't cope with it, and she was one of them. She was too sensitive. She was affected too quickly and easily. Phoebe, as a young woman, was extremely sensitive, but also caring and compassionate. She was artistically gifted and creative. She was strong-willed and often quick-tempered, but she had a great sense of humor. She tended to feel emotions very deeply and was prone to bouts of melancholy. So she sounds like an artist. Phoebe was loyal in many ways, and if she was your friend, you could always count on her. She was also very protective of her younger brothers and had a very close relationship with her grandmother, and she confided in her very often. Phoebe also had plans for the future, and that included traveling to India. She wanted to go there to do charitable work. I'm not going to lie, Phoebe sounds a lot like me, except I never ran away or dated anyone twice my age, but no judgment because I did just about everything else. So how and why she died is a disturbing tale of alleged cover-ups, police bungling, drugs, and alleged murder. 6 years after Phoebe's death, her family is still searching for answers. Her mother says she cannot get thoughts of her oldest child and only daughter out of her mind. A vibrant but troubled young woman with a bright smile. Her absence has, quote, completely shattered their family. And her mother said, nothing will ever be the same for us. And she said, it is truth we are missing here. We are being told that our daughter, granddaughter, and sister put herself into this thing because she was a damaged, disturbed girl, and it's just not true. I don't know what happened. I just feel sure she didn't put herself down that chute, either accidentally or on purpose. So here, we have another accident, suicide, or murder case, much like Rebecca Zahow. The police believed it was suicide. The coroner believed it was a freak accident, but her family believes it was murder. Phoebe's mother didn't believe that she would purposefully put herself down a trash chute. She said she would have believed if she'd maybe overdosed on pills or killed herself in some other way, but definitely not this. At the time of her death, Phoebe was living with her 43-year-old boyfriend, Aunt Hampel. The relationship seemed to be one-sided in terms of power, and it seemed as though it wasn't going to last. So Anthony, Aunt Hampel, was a music promoter and event planner and the son of former Victorian Supreme Court Judge George Hampel. The relationship with Phoebe, who was much younger, seemed tumultuous, and this wasn't just opinion. They actually separated four times or so in the 6 weeks prior to her death. Phoebe was still drinking, and Aunt referred to Phoebe's drinking problem as the monster. They met in 2009 when he was almost 40 and she was 23. She was working as a receptionist at Lindley Godfrey's hair salon in South Yarra, where Hampel regularly got his hair cut. Aunt Hampel is the son of retired Supreme Court judge, as we said, and also the stepson of serving county court judge Felicity Hampel. So judge, troubled son, I guess. On December 2nd, 2010, Phoebe was alone in the luxury high-rise apartment at the Balencia complex in Melbourne that she shared with Aunt. She was last seen on the apartment's CCTV footage with Aunt's dog, Yoshi, after a fire alarm sounded at 11:44 a.m. and she evacuated the building. She and the dog returned to the apartment 6 minutes later. Over the next few hours, Phoebe consumed enough alcohol to put her three times over the legal driving limit. She also took sleeping pills, as traces of them were found in her blood after her death. At some point, she left the apartment and walked into the rubbish room on the 12th floor and entered the garbage chute. Why, or if this is actually how these events occurred, is unknown. What is known is that around 7 p.m., her body is found at the bottom of the garbage chute by a female concierge that worked in the building. Phoebe had plunged 40 meters, or 131 feet down, which is really high, and landed in a garbage bin below. Phoebe actually survived the fall, but her right foot was completely severed by the trash compactor, almost completely severed. I think it was hanging on maybe by a tendon. Her jeans were around her knees and her belt was unbuckled. Her sunglasses sat beside her. Phoebe tried to drag herself to the exit door, but sadly bled out and died before anyone could find her. At around 8 p.m., police arrived on the scene, but refused to allow paramedics access to Phoebe's body, claiming that they might disturb a potential crime scene. So it's possible that Phoebe may have still been alive when the paramedics and police arrived, and they just let her die in the fucking garbage, rather than potentially disturb evidence. By 9:40 p.m., after the police spoke to the concierge, they had made up their collective minds that Phoebe had killed herself. A plainclothes police officer even told the concierge not to beat herself up because this girl took her own life. Well, she found a dead person, so I think she's allowed to be upset. And the question remains, how and why did Phoebe get into the garbage chute, which was barely 20 centimeters or roughly 8 inches, like a little over 8 inches wide, before falling down the chute? So those are the facts that are known regarding Phoebe's death. Now let's get into the other events of that day and evening. Aunt Hampel drove his Range Rover into the Balencia building's basement garage at 6:05 p.m., The exact time is known because he used his security fob or swipe card to open the gate. He'd gone to the gym around 8:15 a.m., which I'm assuming was in the building, and then left the complex just after 9 a.m. for a busy day at his events company in Richmond. He had meetings both on and off-site throughout the day, which is important. Keep that in mind. Aunt used his personal key fob swipe card thing. I guess I'll call it a swipe card from here on out, which only gave him access to the 12th floor that he lived on, and he took the elevator up to his apartment. He says he couldn't remember if his front door was locked when he arrived, when asked later by investigators, but his American Staffordshire Bull Terrier, Yoshi, greeted him upon arrival. I have a Staffy too. Yoshi had made quite a mess, it seemed, pulling off couch cushions and using the bathroom in the apartment. Even though Aunt was a neat freak, he didn't mind that his dog had made the mess. He claims that he looked around, but there was no sign of his live-in girlfriend, Phoebe Handstruck. Their relationship hadn't been the most stable, and Phoebe had moved out and back in several times over the previous weeks. Phoebe was drinking excessively and would disappear for days at a time to hang out with people that Aunt considered lowlifes. He claimed that Phoebe was hanging around with drug dealers and abusers. She would eventually return to Aunt tearfully and have to sedate herself with prescription medication and alcohol just to tolerate their relationship. So this sounds like a very good and healthy relationship. When Ant looked on the kitchen counter, he noticed Phoebe's keys and handbag. This was concerning to him. You could leave the Balencia without keys, but you couldn't get back in, so he thought that she must still be in the building. Also, strange because most women don't leave home without their handbag. Ant also found several post-it notes containing strange scribbles stuck to the kitchen counter. They had a house cleaner who had come by the previous day to wipe down the surfaces, so these notes had to have been new. He then went into the bedroom and found what he called a shrine on their bed. This shrine consisted of photos of Ant and Phoebe, a photo of her cat, and a lot of, quote, rambled notes. The notes she writes when she's smashed, and they don't make a lot of sense, and that is how he described them. There were also candles burning, along with Phoebe's hair straightening iron, lying on the bathroom floor, still plugged in. Okay, this is a weird scene to come upon, if that's actually how he found it. Some things like the plugged-in hair straightener and the keys and purse being left behind would indicate that she was planning on returning shortly and not planning on leaving the building. But I will agree that the shrine thing is pretty strange, again, if that's how he actually found it. At 6:51 p.m., about 40 minutes after Aunt came home, Phoebe's father, Lynn, called her on her iPhone. Lynn and Aunt have differing versions of what happened next. According to Lynn, who based his recollection and the numbers shown on his phone bill, that's how he drew this conclusion, claims that Aunt answered Phoebe's phone. Aunt said that he didn't hear Lynn call Phoebe's phone, but called from him from his own phone at 6:52 p.m. because he thought Phoebe might have gone to meet Lynn when he couldn't find her. Huh. Well, I would definitely remember if my daughter's boyfriend answered her phone at a time when I couldn't get a hold of her, so I'm going to go ahead and trust her father's memory, and also it was on his phone bill that he called Phoebe's phone. So Lynn told Aunt over the phone that he was trying to reach Phoebe because she'd made a reservation for them to eat at a restaurant called the Golden Triangle, and it was her favorite restaurant, and this was to celebrate Lynn's birthday that was 2 days earlier. So Lynn was calling his daughter to ask what time they would meet. And again, this is strange because suicidal people don't typically make reservations or plans to go out for dinner for people's birthdays. Aunt told Lynn that she wasn't there, but her bag and keys were, so she couldn't be too far away. This obviously worried Lynn because the day before, on Wednesday, he and several other family members had received a very strange text message from Phoebe's iPhone. And that message read, "Hi, family. I am in bed and about to sleep, and when I wake, I will transform into the most incredible human being you've ever seen. Not, I will go to hospital. It's safer there. And I hear the special tonight is tomato soup. Delicious. Nutritious. I love you all very much, but not enough to send an individual text. Sorry about that. But time is sleep, and I must be, the letter B, on my way. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. XO." Phoebe had sent that message via a group text to Lynn, Aunt, her boss, who was Michelle Silvana, her mother Natalie, her brothers Tom and Nick, her grandmother Jeanette Campbell, and to her mother Natalie's boyfriend, Russell Marriott. So Natalie, her mother, received the message just as she was boarding a plane in Alice Springs to fly home after she had worked 9 weeks in the Western Desert. So she was concerned, obviously. And she called her own mother, Jeanette, in Mallacoota, which is a township in eastern Victoria, and she asked her to go check on Phoebe. I've received this kind of alarming text from someone before, and I did the exact same thing. I immediately called my family to check on the person. Luckily, they were fine. They had just drank too much and sent messages in the middle of the night. Still very concerning. If you ever get that kind of message from someone, check on them. Don't ignore it. Concerned, Phoebe's grandmother Jeanette called Aunt's phone at 10:35 a.m. and asked him if Phoebe was all right. He said he hadn't seen the message and had left Phoebe sleeping in their bed that morning. Aunt assured her that he'd drop by later to check on her because his office wasn't far from their home. Jeanette then sent Natalie a text saying Aunt had reassured her that Phoebe was fine. So when Natalie arrived in Melbourne later that day, she just sent a follow-up text to Phoebe asking her to call when she woke up. This is a lot. I feel like I would have probably just gone to her front door at this point. This is too much back and forth. Lynn was very concerned that Phoebe wasn't in the apartment, especially after the strange text, and he suggested that Aunt report her missing. Aunt disregarded the suggestion, saying that they don't listen until 48 hours have passed and that she would be back by then. Lynn, who is a psychiatrist, had made the phone calls from the garage at his office building. Not knowing where to go or what to do because, you know, he thought he had plans, he called his son Tom and asked him to call a friend who might know where Phoebe was. Lynn also made a call to Natalie, who said she still hadn't heard from Phoebe. Natalie had been reassured by her own mother's texts, you know, what Aunt said, and she went on with preparations for her son Nick's 18th birthday party the next day. Since she thought nothing was wrong, she put the whole thing out of her mind. But after Lynn's phone call, Natalie called around some of Phoebe's friends, including a man named Bryn Hessian. Bryn said he hadn't seen Phoebe since Monday night when the two of them had gone out for a drink, and he claimed that she had gone on a bit of a bender. Instead of driving over to Phoebe's apartment, Lynn drove home to get ready for dinner, just assuming that he would hear from his daughter shortly. Meanwhile, back at Valencia, Aunt called the restaurant, the Golden Triangle, to order a takeout delivery for one. And he said, "I was becoming very concerned at that point." He was apparently so concerned that he used his computer, had a beer, and ordered takeout. When the delivery person arrived around 8 p.m., he mentioned that there were tons of police in the downstairs lobby. He said, "The front of the building is swarming with cops. There's police cars, ambulance. I had to prop my bike up in the street. Hope your dinner isn't cold." This definitely wasn't a normal occurrence at the luxury high-rise, and Aunt walked down to the lobby to speak to a police officer. Aunt asked an officer what was going on and told him that he lived in the building. The policeman, Acting Senior Sergeant Andrew Healy, told Aunt that a woman's body had been found in the garbage compactor room. And he said, "Oh no, my girlfriend is missing. Could it be her?" Aunt told Sergeant Healy that he'd been at work all day, but had made multiple calls to their home phone as Phoebe's cell phone was broken. He offered up the details that she was suffering from depression and was taking medication. Aunt went on to explain that he'd made a couple of calls to try to find her after he'd arrived home, but he said she usually turned up on her own, and this was common for her to just disappear. How common is it for her to disappear without taking any of her shit with her? He also stated that Phoebe had left some post-it notes, but they gave no clues as to where she may have gone. Sergeant Healy asked Aunt whether Phoebe had any distinguishing features like scars or tattoos, and Aunt told him that she had a tattoo on her right wrist to match one on his own wrist, which he held up his wrist then to show the detective, and that she also had a stud in her upper lip. After sending Aunt back to his apartment to find a recent photograph, Sergeant Healy viewed a photo that another police officer had taken of the deceased woman's body. He then followed up Aunt to his apartment, where he asked if Phoebe had a tattoo on her stomach. Sergeant Healy examined a recent photo and confirmed that Phoebe's facial features did match those of the dead girl in the garbage room. It was at this point that he told Aunt that it appeared that the dead girl was Phoebe. The detective later reported that he had no cellular reception in the apartment, so he went downstairs, leaving Aunt alone in a fucking crime scene. He later returned to investigate the apartment with several other officers. Upon investigation, the officers noted several things of interest. Sergeant Healy observed that there was a broken glass on the floor with blood next to it. Officers also saw the post-it notes allegedly left by Phoebe stuck to the kitchen counter. Oh, and the dog was in the process of ripping up another pillow from the couch, because that's commonplace, I guess. When asked if he wanted to see the body to confirm it was her, Aunt claimed that he was too devastated. Satisfied with their investigation inside the apartment, the officers focused on the other areas of the 12th floor. They found blood on the floor of the 12th level refuse room, where the garbage chute was located, and a spot of blood on the door handle of the room itself, but not actually on the chute door. At this point, Aunt is left alone again, and he called his mother, Suzanne Owen, and stepfather, Robert. He didn't call his father and stepmother, retired judge, remember, George Hample, and Justice Felicity Hample, because they were out of town. Okay, so to recap, Phoebe leaves the apartment at some point in the afternoon with candles lit and her hair straightening iron plugged in, doesn't take her purse or keys. There's a broken glass and blood on the floor of the apartment. Her phone is supposedly broken, but she was able to send the strange text the day before, and she had made plans to take her father to dinner, and it seems kind of like she was ready, like getting ready to go out. She had the hair straightening iron on. Seems like she was probably getting ready.
There's only one point during the day when someone could have come into the building without a security card or key fob, and it was while the fire alarm was pulled. Remember, the fire alarm was pulled and all of the security was disabled. So someone could have come in without a key fob. And it was confirmed also that Phoebe was alive at this time by the CCTV footage. So Phoebe's boyfriend then answered her phone when her own father calls. And at this point, doesn't know she's dead, but goes ahead and ordered takeout from the very restaurant that they were supposed to be going to that evening. And he orders it for one instead of two. And remember, he said he thought she was coming back. So wouldn't he order for two people instead of one? When he talks to the police,
Aunt immediately puts it in their minds that Phoebe is a suicidal alcoholic on medication. They had also been fighting for weeks prior to her death, and she had tried to leave him. So Aunt is left alone in the apartment before it can be inspected by police, and is left alone again right after they give it a brief once-over. Aunt refused to look at her body and calls his parents first instead of calling Phoebe's parents. Okay, none of this looks suspicious or weird at all. This is totally how I would have done things. Not even in the slightest, though. Aunt finally calls Lynn and tells him that his daughter is dead and that he and her brothers should come to the Balencia. Lynn said later, "I was in shock at this and just sat there on the floor." He called his son Tom in tears, but couldn't bring himself to tell him. "I didn't want to tell him on the phone. There's nothing that can be done," he said to Tom. "Just come home." Not knowing what had happened, Tom left his girlfriend's house and headed for the city. Lynn also tried calling Natalie again, but she didn't answer. Later, while Natalie was unloading her car, she saw that she had two voicemails from Lynn. When she called him back, she asked, "What happened? Have you found Phoebe?" Lynn could barely speak, but he managed to tell her, "I hope you're sitting down. She's dead. They found her near the rubbish bins at the apartment." Natalie fell on her knees in the street next to her car and screamed. And when her partner, Russell Marriott, came outside after hearing her scream, he picked her up and carried her into the house. Russell then called Jeanette, Natalie's mother, who had come to Melbourne from Mallacoota that day for Nick's birthday party. Russell asked her to come to their house immediately, and Jeanette knew right away it was about Phoebe, and she asked if everything was okay. But Russell just told her to come as soon as possible. When Jeanette got to Natalie's home, they told her that Phoebe was dead, but no one could understand it. Jeanette showed Natalie two texts from that morning and that she'd sent them to Aunt asking how they both were, and that he had replied at 8:32 a.m. saying, quote, "Thanks, Marm. She is sleeping beauty right now and not the beast she was, resting well, and I've explained how it's time to heal. Then when she feels okay, we'll work out a plan." And I would have told that dude to wake her up and put her on the phone because I don't need him calling my daughter a monster. Okay, thanks. The concierge who found Phoebe was a woman named Beth Ozelup, and she made a 000 call, which is the Australian equivalent to 911. Intergraph, which was the emergency dispatch service, had allocated the job to South Melbourne Police Unit 303, the afternoon shift van at 7:14 p.m., and it was the shift supervisor's car, Unit 251, that also attended. South Melbourne is very close to St. Kilda Road, where the apartment complex was located, so the police arrived very quickly. First on the scene were Acting Senior Sergeant Healy, Detective Senior Constable Paul Thomas, Senior Constable Justin O'Brien, Constable Claire Hawking, and Sergeant Graham Forster, the shift supervisor. Beth met them at the building's door and gave them the keys to the rubbish room. She called her sister, who came to comfort her. Sometime later, after her sister came to take Beth home, a police officer told them not to worry too much. He said, quote, "The girl had committed suicide and put herself down the rubbish chute." Eric Giammario and Tony Basil, the manager of the company that operated the apartments, had soon arrived after the police, somewhere between 7:15 and 7:30 p.m. Eric went straight to the office and saw how upset Beth was, so he decided it was best not to go into the compactor room. He wouldn't have been allowed to anyway because they weren't letting anyone inside. He saw a distraught Aunt Hample come down with the police, who asked for a room to conduct their interviews in. Eric was trying to be as helpful as possible, and it occurred to him that the building's security cameras might be helpful to the police, so he told them they needed to act quickly because he'd been having trouble with the CCTV. The looping time for the record was too short, so the machine was recording over pretty new tapes, typically within 2 days. He said, I suggested to the police that if they needed any CCTV, they should start downloading. He later said that the police didn't really respond to his suggestion, although they did watch some footage with him in the office. An ambulance had been called at 7:20 p.m. and arrived 7 minutes later. The paramedics' presence added to the chaos in the relatively small lobby and the corridor next to the rubbish compactor room. Christy Cook, one of the paramedics, immediately went to where the focus appeared to be, a doorway along the corridor where an unmoving body was lying. The police officer guarding the door told her the room was a crime scene and that she wasn't permitted to enter. This went against all of Christy's training and instincts, but the police were in charge and wouldn't let her in. She said that from the doorway, she could see that a female was lying on her back with cuts to her right thigh and hip and with her foot in a very unnatural position. Yeah, because it was hanging off, which led her to believe there was an ankle fracture. She noticed the body showed generalized cyanosis, a bluish tinge, no spontaneous respirations, and appeared deceased. Regardless of whether or not Phoebe appeared deceased, paramedics should have been allowed to make that call while police supervised the scene. Christy was extremely upset about not being allowed to render medical aid. In fact, no medically trained person attended Phoebe after she was discovered. No one laid hands on her to see if she was still warm or checked to see if she had a pulse or if she was actually dead. They just looked at her and assumed. So rather than medical professionals, the first people to enter the room after it was declared a crime scene were the crime scene specialist, and they didn't arrive until several hours later. They claim that, based on blood trails, it was likely that Phoebe had survived the fall, which we already said, and crawled around trying to get out of the room. So she survived that fall and very well could have been alive, and a crowd of people, including police and paramedics, just stood outside that door. Now let's talk about the investigation, and I'm using air quotes here. You can't see it. Maybe I should do some YouTubing so you can see like how animated my face and hands get when I talk, because there really wasn't much of an investigation, despite a very bizarre death and scene. The investigators said there were items in the apartment, remember, that indicated there might have been a fight. They found a broken glass on the floor with blood next to it. The couch cushions had also been ripped up, and it looked as if most of the rooms had been tossed. Despite the fact that the apartment looked like a crime scene and the bizarre way in which she died, the investigators pretty much immediately decided that her death was a suicide. Aunt Hample shared this view. In his statement to police on the day of her death, Aunt said, "I believe that as a result of Phoebe's depression and alcohol abuse, she took her life tonight." Because apparently this guy is a psychiatrist and not a party promoter slash event planner. It's also believed that the statement made by George, Aunt's father, who was a very well-respected and powerful judge, influenced the investigation. George reiterated to police that Phoebe had killed herself because she was a depressed alcoholic. Phoebe was, indeed, troubled at the time of her death. She was very unhappy in her relationship with Aunt, which was not a secret. Many people knew. And during the coronial inquest, it was found that Aunt and Phoebe had argued on the morning she died, and he had called her phone 27 times afterward. I am extremely confused. He said her phone is broken. How is he calling her? How is anyone talking to her? I'm so, so confused. Her psychologist cited that Phoebe felt unequal in the relationship and that she felt Aunt had control of her. Her mother agreed as well. The age difference was a large part of that, but there was definitely more to it. Psychologist Joanna Young, who actually treated Phoebe, said in August of 2013 in an inquest, "I think she was not happy about the fact that she was not an equal in that relationship. She felt quite dependent on him." Lindley Godfrey, who had known Phoebe and owned the salon that she worked at, and she also knew Aunt Hample before they started dating, didn't expect the relationship to last. And she said, "I thought Phoebe was just going to shag him and flick him." So I guess that means like fuck him and dump him. The Australian version sounds nicer, right? They went out for 5 months before Phoebe moved into his St. Kilda Road apartment at the Valencia in October of 2009. They seemed to be a very odd couple because she was a young artist and very down to earth, and he was a middle-aged party boy. She loved painting and creative clutter, and he wanted the apartment to look like nobody lived there, and that is a statement made by his house cleaner.
Phoebe's mother went to the apartment once that she shared with Aunt and asked, "Where are you here?" Meaning that there was no trace of Phoebe or her personality anywhere in the very sterile apartment. Aunt apparently didn't want her things there, even though she did live there and pay rent, because he didn't like a mess. I also hate clutter, but I don't want my house to look like no one lives in it. That is just joyless. Aunt was so controlling about the appearance of the apartment that Phoebe left the salon early one day, stressed out about cleaning an ink stain from the apartment's carpet before Aunt came home. She told psychologist Joanna Young, who was concerned Phoebe was potentially suicidal, that Aunt constantly put her down and made her feel stupid. Aunt told the inquest Phoebe was self-destructive and struggled every day to do the simplest things. So fucking break up with her, dude, if she's that terrible. That sounds like an emotionally abusive statement to me. If you constantly tell someone that they can't do anything right, then yeah, it would make it seem as though they struggled when really you just have standards that no one can live up to and that you probably don't want them to. You would rather just put them down because you enjoy it. Natalie says her daughter drank to overcome her insecurities around Aunt and his friends, who were older, attractive, and wealthy. She once called her mom upset and said, "Mom, I just don't know what to do. I love Aunt, but it's not working." So she drank to cope with a terrible relationship. Been there. Phoebe's grandfather, retired police sergeant Lorne Campbell, said that she felt like nothing she did was right and that she just couldn't please him. In the weeks prior to her death, Phoebe tried to leave 4 times. We already talked about that. But on each occasion, after she spoke to Aunt, he somehow convinced her to come back. Abusive. It's just a cycle, constant cycle. Her mother said in the days prior to her death, she noticed that Phoebe wasn't doing well. They had a conversation in Phoebe's room at the apartment, and when her mother asked if she'd patched things up with Aunt, Phoebe raised her finger to her mother's mouth to silence her. So clearly, things aren't going well if the woman can't even speak freely in her own home. Although she was struggling in her relationship, Phoebe was excited about the future and was making plans for her brother's 18th birthday, yet another reason that her family does not believe she was suicidal. So let's get into that suicide theory. Her grandfather and many people had the same question. Is it even possible for someone to put themselves into a garbage chute unassisted? Putting yourself down a garbage chute doesn't seem like a very common method of suicide. In fact, I have never heard of it outside of this case, and neither had Phoebe's grandfather, who was a retired police sergeant. I actually looked into it, and I could suicide by garbage chute. I found 3 deaths by garbage chute, accidental or suspected. So the police suicide theory assumed not only that she was able to get into the chute unassisted, but that she was able to do so while heavily intoxicated. Remember, the toxicology blood alcohol content of 0.16%, 3 times the legal limit, and sleeping pills, their brand name Stilnox, which is another version of Ambien. While the amount of the drug in her system was within the normal range for a therapeutic dose, the combination of the alcohol and Stilnox would have put her in a state of heavy drowsiness. So how does a woman who is drowsy and intoxicated manage to open a heavy garbage chute door and put herself into it? This act would seem to require a great deal of coordination, which her grandfather claimed she did not have while intoxicated. It seemed like everybody said that, like she just could not handle alcohol. He said that Phoebe did not tolerate alcohol well, but that she was quite fond of it. He said she would lose her balance very quickly when she drank, and that coupled with Stilnox, that would have made the police version of events all but impossible. The police suicide theory was reached even before they tested it out, not taking into account the part where she was heavily under the influence. So get this, police did not, at any point, attempt to recreate Phoebe's death to see if it was even possible. While the police didn't recreate her death to see if it were possible, her grandfather did. "Phoebe loved life," said her grandfather, Lauren Campbell. "Not a day goes by when I don't think of her and the horror of it." He was planning to see her on his 70th birthday in December of 2010. Instead, he went to see the garbage chute at her apartment. He was floored by how small the hatch was. "There's no way Phoebe could have climbed inside in her condition," is what he said. Then there were no fingerprints on the chute door or the surroundings, which were made of steel. And You know how that is. You touch something made of stainless steel or steel, they smudge, prints get on it. Furthermore, they appeared to have been wiped clean. Right from the start, I believed she had been murdered, said her grandfather. So Lauren Campbell was a police officer for more than 30 years and was like a, quote, dog with a bone when it came to catching criminals. And that's how he was described by coworkers. So when homicide detectives decided within 5 days that Phoebe had likely committed suicide, he started his own investigation. And I would have, too. An exact replica of the garbage chute was set up with his help in order to put the suicide theory to the test. I can post this video. It is wild. A woman who was the same height and weight as Phoebe and wearing similar clothes was used as a stand-in with one very glaring difference. She was completely sober. She immediately comments on how small the chute opening is, and right from the beginning, she struggled. The chute is 1 meter, roughly 3.3 feet from the ground, and 22 centimeters, or like we already talked about, which is a little over like 8.5 inches wide. So that's high up and really tiny. This girl looked pretty fit and strong, but she struggled to even get one leg in and nearly falls over several times. And again, she is dead sober. Her weight on the door causes the bolts to come out of position, and Phoebe's grandfather actually had to catch her. Her legs became trapped, and they had to pull her out. Once the door was pushed open, the lid essentially closed on her. So she tried a second time, and she again struggled a great deal just to get one leg in and repeatedly fell over. After a great deal of acrobatics, and I mean she had a great deal of upper body strength, she is able to wedge herself in, but it starts to close on her. She can only slide down the chute with her arms straight up above her head. It was impossible to enter the chute head first. So, a very strong, very sober woman who was the same size as Phoebe barely got in there, and I mean barely, and was only able to do so by sliding down feet first with her arms raised straight above her head. It does not really compute that a woman that was heavily intoxicated would have been able to perform this feat. And I will post that video. It is crazy. It makes me nervous. I get anxious just watching it, not because it's like a tight space, but because this woman is struggling and falling. So the stand-in was trembling afterward and said it was an incredibly scary and tight fit. She said the hardest part was the way the door closed onto her as she was being pushed in. The door itself is heavily weighted and has a spring hinge, so it snaps to close. Again, police never recreated this experiment in order to support their hypothesis, much to the surprise of outside experts and investigators. And after only 5 days of investigating, police passed the case off to detectives from the South Melbourne Police Station. There are many glaring oversights in the original investigation. Firstly, they failed to secure all of the CCTV footage from Phoebe's apartment complex on the day of her death. So there's actual video footage, and they just didn't really look at it. And the manager told police on the night of Phoebe's death that the footage was going to be recorded over. So why did they immediately not take the footage? Rather than immediately obtaining that footage, the police waited 18 months before requesting the hard drive of the building's CCTV, and it obviously couldn't be found at that point. So not only did they fail to obtain the CCTV footage, but they also failed to obtain or search any of the electronic devices in the apartment. When her family was finally able to access Phoebe's laptop, they claimed that all of her outgoing emails had been deleted. Phoebe also had 2 cell phones. Okay, now I'm seeing the phone deal. A Nokia and an iPhone. And the Nokia phone has never been recovered or located. So it would seem that there wasn't really any sort of investigation conducted as to Phoebe's method of death because the police decided it was a suicide, so it just wasn't necessary to collect any more evidence. This also shows the danger of making assumptions without actually conducting an investigation. There are too many strange contradictions that should have been pursued here, including the fact that there were 2 glasses sitting out on the kitchen island in Phoebe's apartment. Those glasses weren't dusted for fingerprints, nor were their contents tested. The coroner surmised that it was actually the broken glass on the floor that led Phoebe to take the garbage to the disposal room. However, there were no glass shards that matched the one in her apartment actually found in the garbage. The coroner also believed that Phoebe had cut herself while cleaning up the broken glass in the apartment, but there was no blood or fingerprints found on the entry hatch to the garbage chute. So holes everywhere, holes everywhere. Former Supreme Court Judge Wheelie was brought in as an outside investigator, and he cited several more failures made in the police investigation. He claims that the police did not photograph or test the blood found on the 12th floor refuse room door. They also did not check all of the garbage bins in the apartment, nor did they photograph or try to identify footprints found outside the apartment. Judge Wheelie said that there was material evidence that pointed to the fact that someone else was involved in her death. Yeah, duh. There was bruising on her body that did not comport with falling down a trash chute. Rather, they were consistent with someone else inflicting them upon her. Phoebe had bruises on her arms and wrist consistent with someone gripping them. Other pieces of evidence that don't support the suicide theory are some of the items Phoebe had with her. She had her sunglasses with her, and also her jeans were down around her ankles. Who pulled her jeans down? If she were sliding down, like down a chute, physics would dictate that her pants would be pushed up, not pulled down, right? So I feel like that's just common sense, and that leads me to believe that maybe someone else was in the refuse room with her. Perhaps coincidentally, because the fire alarm had gone off that morning, the apartment complex's security system was compromised. An intruder or someone that lived there and didn't want to be detected by their swipe card could have gained access to the 12th floor and exited through the fire escape without swiping their card or using a key during that time. This detail alone should have been enough to cast doubt on the suicide theory and should have drawn attention to the myriad of suspicious circumstances. Without having tested their suicide theory, the police claimed that it was easier for Phoebe to put herself down the chute than for someone to put her down it while unconscious. The detective's report to the coroner actually said that verbatim. So I'm going to go ahead and disagree with them on that one. Again, I watched the video of that woman attempting to do this dead ass sober, and it was not easy. So Phoebe's grandfather decided to test that theory as well, with the same female stand-in and a tall male. This guy legit slid her into the chute like a slice of bread into a toaster, absolutely no problem. It took one attempt and about 15 seconds. Yikes. So much debunking, so much doubt. So let's get into the inquest. I've mentioned it a couple of times. Let's get into the details of that. In March of 2013, 3 years after Phoebe's death, her family was told that there would be a coronial inquest. And I had to look this one up because I know nothing about Australian law. A coronial inquest is a public inquiry to determine the identity of a dead person, how they died, and the place, date, and cause of their death. In Western Australia, inquests are conducted by a coroner under the Coroner's Act of 1996. So it kind of sounds like exactly what it is. I just wanted to make sure. Natalie raised about $50,000, including money from donations and her own savings to cover her family's legal costs for the inquest. They were thrilled because they believed that this was an opportunity for any evidence that was previously missed to be examined. Aunt Hampel, however, opposed the inquest. He argued that the evidence alone was not enough to suggest that her death was caused by homicide. Personally, I don't think there's enough evidence to prove that her death was not a homicide. Hampel told the inquest that the night before her death, Phoebe was in recovery mode from a heavy drinking session. Okay, so she was hungover. God. She was still in bed when he left for work the next morning, he says. The last time Phoebe was seen alive was the lobby CCTV cameras during the fire evacuation. And on that tape, she was apparently stumbling slightly as she held the dog's leash. Yeah, but she was still functioning enough to walk a dog and had the wherewithal to leave during a fire evacuation. She could have just stayed in there. Again, I've lived in an apartment complex similar. It's annoying when the fire alarms go off and you know, like, there's not a real fire, but you can stay in your apartment. You don't have to leave. Nobody comes and gets you out. The inquest took 14 days, and coroner Peter White had about 30 witnesses come forward and reviewed thousands of pages of evidence. Again, I'm confused where these thousands of pages of evidence came from because they don't seem to have any evidence whatsoever. He had assisting counsel as well, and together they provided a 65-page document. In it, the assisting counsel, Deborah Siemensma, recommended an open finding, which meant that the case could be reinvestigated in the future. Coroner White disregarded his assistant counselor's recommendation, which is, by all accounts, uncommon. The coroner's conclusion completely disagreed with his assistant counsel, and he handed down the finding that Phoebe's death was, quote, a tragic accident by misadventure. Phoebe's family was devastated by that finding and disagreed with it wholeheartedly. So the outcome of the inquest was obviously a blow to her family, especially seeing as how the coroner ignored his submissions from assistant counsel. Semensma, the assistant counsel, felt the combination of evidence, including unexplained bruises to Phoebe's upper arms, the blood in the apartment, and the lack of fingerprints on the chute, as well as the inadequacies of the initial police investigation, did not, quote, enable a positive finding to be made on the balance of probabilities as to the involvement of Mr. Hample or another third party. Semensma continued, that is not to say that he had any involvement, but rather there is an inability to exculpate on the balance of probabilities, adding aspects of Mr. Hample's evidence that were unsatisfactory. So assistant counsel recommended to leave Phoebe's case open because there wasn't enough contradictory evidence of Aunt Hample or any other party's guilt slash participation in her death, but the coroner decided to go another route. The fact that the Still Knox was in her system became the primary focus of Coroner White. He actually suggested that the combination of alcohol and Still Knox in Phoebe's system accidentally caused her to sleepwalk to the chute. Again, I'll post the video of the woman who was sober and attempting this. It did not happen that way. Toxicologist Dr. Naren Gunja claimed that the act of climbing into a garbage chute did not match the typical side effects of Still Knox. Dr. Gunja says the typical side effects include sleep eating, sleepwalking, and sleep cleaning, but definitely not something like forcing your body into a garbage chute. He says that people typically do things while sleepwalking that they would do every day, like eating or cleaning. His view is that the ingestion of alcohol and Still Knox would make the entry of Phoebe into that garbage chute less likely, if not impossible. Two more toxicologists also went over the evidence and gave their opinions during the inquest. Each one said the same thing. Under the influence of alcohol and Still Knox, it would be nearly impossible for Phoebe to put herself into the garbage chute. Coroner White, despite multiple toxicologists saying that Phoebe likely couldn't have done this, claimed that once she was in the chute, she tried to control her fall. And this is a quote from him. She commenced to move down the chute by pressing her extremities and her bottom against the opposite walls of the chute, thereby controlling herself in descent. But if you remember in the recreation, the woman could only go down the chute with her arms above her head, so it would have been impossible for her to slow herself down by pressing her extremities against the chute walls, as Coroner White had claimed. Four expert witnesses also stated that there was no evidence that Phoebe had attempted to control her fall or slow herself down. There was no evidence found on her hands, arms, or clothing to suggest this. These experts stated that Phoebe would have been covered in dirt and grime if she attempted to slow her fall. But again, the coroner disregarded this evidence. Coroner White not only concluded that Phoebe's death was a tragic accident caused by misadventure, but he made sure to honor the request of Aunt Hample's attorneys and fully exonerated him of any responsibility in her death. Okay, then. So the only person to benefit from this inquest was Aunt Hample. Phoebe's family had hoped that the inquest would result in an open finding so that the evidence could be reexamined. Her family believes that Phoebe was likely put down the chute by someone else. I also believe that. Once the coroner had made his findings, they were virtually unchallengeable. The only way to appeal this decision was to prove that he had made an error of law, and apparently this just does not happen. It seems that the Handstruck family just has to live with the findings of the coronial inquest. So, to recap, the official version of events that the coroner put forth claims that Phoebe was sleepwalking under the influence of alcohol and Still Knox when she walked to the garbage chute carrying a garbage bag, which has never been found, containing pieces of a broken glass, which has also never been found. She leaves the remainder of the broken glass on the floor of her apartment. Once inside the garbage room, Phoebe climbs into the chute, leaving no blood or fingerprints on the chute entry. That conclusion seems to be speculation that isn't supported by any evidence at all. So, where's Aunt in all this? Let's say Phoebe didn't kill herself and didn't die by misadventure. Who would have wanted to hurt Phoebe? I think the most likely suspect is her boyfriend, Aunt Hample, although I'm not saying that he did or did not have anything to do with her death. However, there are just a lot of strange details surrounding her death, and he didn't seem all too upset by her being missing or by her death itself. I'm just saying, there may not have been a proper investigation conducted concerning his involvement because his dad and stepmom were judges. But wouldn't you know it, another one of Aunt's much younger girlfriends also supposedly died by a strange suicide. Bailey Schneider, 25, was found unconscious by her parents slumped against the kitchen cupboards with a gold cord around her neck at their home in Melbourne on June 24th, 2018. In the hours leading up to her death, she had been in close communication with her ex, 51-year-old Aunt Hample. Bailey was a model and a dental assistant. She had anxiety and depression and was prescribed medication to manage both. So it sounds like Aunt might target women with depression and maybe some chemical dependencies. She told her mother that morning that she had broken up with her older socialite boyfriend and that they had fought afterward. On June 22nd, 2018, Bailey told her parents that she was going to a barbecue at Anthony's home and would be spending the night. Instead, she went to a nightclub where she worked as a dancer from 6:45 p.m. to 1 a.m. At 1:08, Bailey took a taxi to the elite suburb that Aunt lived in for a party where she spent the majority of the night arguing via text. Her friends claim that she seemed very depressed, and at 8 a.m., Bailey took a taxi back home. At 10 a.m., Bailey's mother found her sobbing in her bedroom and having a panic attack. Bailey told her mom that she and Aunt had broken up because their worlds were just too different. After consoling Bailey for a while, her parents left to get groceries. When they left, Bailey was on the couch watching a movie, and her older brother Ryan was in his room that was in the back of the house. When they returned a short time later, they found her lying on the kitchen floor. Her head was leaning against a lower kitchen cabinet, and blood was dripping from her nose. A curtain tie from her bedroom was tightly knotted around her neck. Bailey's dad cut the curtain tie off with a knife and attempted to administer CPR, but it was too late. Bailey was dead. The toxicology report showed that Bailey had traces of cocaine, Zoloft, and Xanax in her system, and her blood alcohol content was 0.17%, three times the legal driving limit. There was also a half-empty bottle of wine found in the kitchen. Her death was initially ruled a suicide, but referred to a homicide squad for further review in December of 2019. Deputy Coroner Caitlin English said that the review established her cause of death in her family home as self-inflicted asphyxiation. However, Bailey was 172 centimeters tall, or 5'6", which is actually my height, and there was nowhere for her to suspend herself in the kitchen. So yeah, how do you hang yourself when you're 5'6" and there's nowhere to hang yourself? Okay. When Bailey's parents brought up their suspicions that someone else was involved, the coroner concluded that Bailey must have hung herself from the pantry door because it was the only viable solution. The case was ruled not suspicious and ultimately closed in 2020. Bailey's older brother Ryan last saw his sister in the garden talking on the phone. He said that she appeared to be distressed, but that she made a hand gesture that signaled that she was okay. Aunt Hample is the last person to have spoken with Bailey, just like in the case of Phoebe Handsjuck. So how do we feel? Well, I'm not saying Aunt Hample has a habit of targeting much younger depressed women with chemical and alcohol dependencies, but yeah, I am actually saying that. I don't think that Phoebe Handsjuck put herself into that garbage chute. I will post the YouTube video of the recreation and you can decide for yourself. But really, this looked damn near impossible while being attempted by a sober woman, and Phoebe was not sober at all. Also, the recreation with the guy, who is not a massive guy at all, just a regular looking guy, he just slides her right into the chute without much effort at all in a matter of seconds. And it is just plain eerie to watch. And to me, that seems probably more likely what happened. I think police did a piss poor job at investigating her death. And I think they listened to Aunt and his father when they claimed that Phoebe was a depressed alcoholic and that she killed herself. It's easy, right? Really nice, neat little package. You can tie it up with a bow and go on about your day. I got news for you, though. You can be a depressed alcoholic and not kill yourself. Hi, hello, I'm still alive. I've been depressed while abusing alcohol to cope, and I didn't kill myself. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm sure it does. But I think it's absolute bullshit when a depressed person dies and immediately their death is ruled a suicide without much investigation. Hello, Kurt Cobain, anyone? Elliot Smith? Their very bizarre deaths were ruled suicides, mainly because of the fact that they were clinically depressed, medicated, and known drug users. Again, I think the significant others in both of those cases should have been more thoroughly investigated, just like in this one. And it's also just too strange that another woman that Aunt Hample dated, who quite frankly was out of his league, she was practically a carbon copy of Phoebe in terms of her psychological profile. How strange is it that she just happened to kill herself also in a very suspicious manner? No, I am sorry. That just doesn't happen to the same person more than once, if at all. I feel like Phoebe was a very troubled woman that needed help and definitely needed to get out of that toxic relationship. I think any problems that she had, mentally or otherwise, were just compounded by this relationship. There likely won't be justice for her if she was murdered because of the fact that the inquest's findings are pretty much final. So that is a sad and infuriating story. Maybe the next one I'll do will be a little lighter. Maybe one where a murderer or someone who does something bad actually gets caught and pays for it. You can hear more episodes on Spotify, Buzzsprout, Apple Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, really, released on Mondays and Fridays. You can find me on Instagram at Autumn's Oddcast. I had to change my name. Let's don't get into that. On Facebook at Autumn's Oddities, and on Patreon at Autumn's Oddities, as well as Twitter at Autumn's Odd Pods or Autumn's Odd Pod. There's also a bonus episode on Patreon specifically for Patreon members only. You'll also get early access as a Patreon. You get the episodes a day early. If there's any topics, any cases you'd like to hear, please feel free to suggest them on one of those platforms, or you can send them to me at autumnsoddities@gmail.com. Make sure to follow wherever you listen or get your podcasts. And if your app allows and you want to support me in a way that is not monetary, you just give me a nice little review so that I can bump up my numbers. And I am a teeny tiny itty bitty teeny weeny baby small operation. I research, write, record the show myself. If you like it, just, you know, follow, subscribe, shout me out on your social media, tell your friends, force them to listen, play it at work, whatever. I hope you keep listening. And remember, if it's creepy and weird, you'll find it here. Hey, I'm going to give a quick Patreon shout out. Thank you to my newest Patreon, my sister, Tessa Bertraw. I appreciate the support and thank you. I'll see you at Christmas, and I'm hosting this year just a couple of weeks after moving into a new house. Hey, I want to read real quick just one of my 5-star reviews on iTunes. This one is from JT Knopf, and they say, I've heard some tales that are brand new to me. I love that she does thorough research. Yes, I do. And also includes a lot of her own personality as she lays out the story. I look forward to new stories. Thank you so much for that review. I am not everyone's cup of tea, so I'm glad you enjoy my personality. And I try to cover cases that aren't overdone or done at all, really, because their stories deserve to be told, too. Thanks for the review, and I hope you keep listening.
Mike and I hope that you enjoyed that episode of Autumn's Oddities. If you liked her show, head over to whichever podcast service you use and hit subscribe. Rate and review the show, and let her know Brew Crime sent you. Remember, you can always find us on all of the social media, for better or worse, at Brew Crime. Leave a rating or a review wherever you listen, and come say hi to us. You can also find us at www.brewcrime.com and on Patreon by searching Brew Crime. Hey, don't say we didn't make it easy for you. Any money goes directly back to the show in the form of software and equipment to make our show even better. Thanks to everyone, and we will see you next week for a featured episode from Cause of Death.
The Oracle Network.